Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. A promising new Alzheimer's drug seems to slow the rate of cognitive decline for patients in the early stages of the disease. We'll talk with the co-director of the Penn Memory Center about why lecanemab seems to work when similar drugs have failed. And it's that time of year when monarch butterflies make their way from Canada to Cape May, New Jersey, and then on to Mexico for the winter. It is a fascinating 3,000-mile journey for these tiny, beautiful insects, and now they are in danger of extinction. We'll find out why. But we begin with the shooting at a football scrimmage in Roxborough at the high school last week that left a 14-year-old football player dead and four other teens injured. It happened when a group of young men jumped out of a stolen SUV and opened fire on players as they left the field. So far this year, 178 children have been shot in Philadelphia, 23 have died. What happened in Roxborough last week has left parents, staff, and students fearful for their safety and asking once again what can be done to help keep kids safe. Joining us to talk about that is Kevin Bethel, Chief Safety Officer for the Philadelphia School District. He is a former Deputy Police Commissioner. Chief Bethel, thanks so much for being with us on the Regional Roundup.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So tell us, first of all, about the students who survived that shooting, the four students. How are they doing at this point?
I understand that all of them are in stable condition, and they're going to survive their injuries. So that's a good thing. But unfortunately, obviously, our prayers goes out to Nicholas and his family for the loss of our Saul student, who tragically died on that day as well.
Yes. Is there any news on the suspects at this point?
That's a police investigation, and I know my colleagues at the Philadelphia Police Department has made this a top priority. We all recognized the impact of having any child shot, but more importantly, a children shot on the school grounds is a priority for the department. And so I'm very confident they will find the individual who did this, but at this current state, that's with the police department in their investigation.
And I know that this is also part of the investigation, but I'm curious to know whether you have heard yet anything about a motive. There were early reports that the shooting may have stemmed from a lunchtime altercation, that one or more students may have been targeted. What do you know about that at this point?
Yeah, I'm not privy to say the motive, but what we do see is a group of cowards who get out of a car who specifically target our students coming from the ball field, and that part we do know, right? And so that'll be a part of the investigation. I'm not privy to that information as to the purpose or why. There is no why. There's no reason why individuals, children leaving a practice field to be targeted and gunned down at any time, at any place, and anywhere in the city or in this country. So hard to understand what reasoning would cause that, even if it was originated with a cafeteria fight. It should never rise to that level, but I have no information that anything happening in the school preceded this incident.
And to that point, Chief, I think what strikes so many people about this is just the sheer randomness of it all. And so the question is, how do you protect kids from something like this? You can't even see it coming.
It's an extreme challenge, right? We have worked hard to make our schools a safe haven. I would say that much of the cases that we see, though, are not as random, but more targeted, as you can see in the video for the incident had at Roxborough, when individuals are coming up to our school targeting specific students. But it's a challenge. I mean, we work hard every day with our support services team, our climate team, the Philadelphia Police Department, and our school leaders and staff to keep our schools safe. But when coming from the community and incidents is happening in the community, which come to the doorsteps of our school, that is a significant challenge and is most frustrating for me, for someone who used to work in that space, recognizing that, you know, if we don't change how we address guns and the possession of guns and the certainty of that, a response to that and the punishment for that, then we're going to continue being on this cycle. And we have to start to do things differently so that what's happening in the community is not now crossing the lines of the school. Those lines are not even existing anymore. It seems more now than ever, you know, wherever I want to shoot a gun, I can shoot a gun. Wherever I want to shoot anyone in the city, You know, and so it's really something that we really, really have to start to, can't keep doing the same things over and over again. We're coming to a mic and giving prayers and having these conversations. We have to start coming up with a strategy that really addresses the root issue. An individual with a gun is the most dangerous person in this city, and we need to start to address that issue.
And in the interim, Chief, can you talk a little bit more specifically about what the school district is doing to protect kids?
And so, as you know, it's particularly in our high schools, we have our metal detectors to try to ensure that guns do not get into our schools. My staff is doing a lot around mentoring. So we are trying to do a more balanced approach to work with our young people in the school setting, working in our mentoring work as we go through our process. One of the other layers we have added was our Safe Path program, where we would put individuals out on the pathways, you know, trusted community leaders, with the hopes that we would abate any activity. Now, again, we have a safe program at Broxborough. Those individuals were done before, you know, the practice. However, I don't even know in that case they would be able to stop the level of violence that we saw that day. And then, obviously, we work with the Philadelphia Police Department. We've created safety zones around many of our schools that we have identified as potential issues, and working with the Philadelphia Police Department where they man additional officers in those areas to help us. So, as you see, we've really worked on a layered approach in our work. But it's a daunting task, as you indicated, and we still continue to work. But I would also say that most of our schools are safe. It is, in my opinion, despite some of the things that have happened most recently, still remains the safest place for our children to be. And there they have school leaders, there where they get the love and the supports and the things that they need in that setting. And so we still, as an organization, recognize, despite all of the violence, and there's a lot of it in our city, that the schools are still the safest place for our kids to be.
Let me bring in Dr. Jamie Banks at this point, Deputy Chief of Prevention, Intervention, and Trauma for the School District of Philadelphia. Dr. Banks, thanks so much for being with us. And let me ask you about how parents and teachers ought to be talking with kids about a traumatic situation like this.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. It is very important that teachers and parents and just anyone who interacts with youth just provide that safe space for youth just to share their thoughts and feelings. In situations like this, sometimes also kids don't have the words to even express what they're thinking. So it just may be train of thought. It just may be kind of, you know, frustrations or just, you know, stream of consciousness of just all that's going on, and just allow that space for them to share that and know that they're in a safe place where they can express those emotions, and that's key. That they have those spaces with those trusting adult relationships where they can share that information. And adults will help connect them to resources and supports if needed, or just, you know, have the opportunity to dialogue about such challenging times.
And Dr. Banks, what signs should adults be looking for to make sure that a child isn't maybe getting stuck in the grieving process and going down a bad path in terms of their mental health?
Of course. So if a child is doing anything different than they normally would, right? So if they are an energetic child and they change their behavior and they're not that child that their parent or caregivers used to seeing, or they see signs and symptoms of increase, you know, irritability, increase or decrease in sleep, or things that they really enjoy they no longer enjoy, if they see changes in any of those type of behaviors, I would say speak to their teacher, speak to their counselor, speak to the pediatrician about what they're seeing as they are seeing it, so that the child can be connected to the proper kind of line of treatment.
And Dr. Banks, finally, what support is there for teachers and staff who are dealing with their own grief and their own concerns in the midst of all this?
Yeah, I mean, we have been trying to create as many spaces and connections to supports for our adults as, you know, that is what's needed. For our teachers and staff, we have been bringing our employee assistance program into schools And even when they're not into schools, that's a resource that's available for our staff. So it's our employee assistance program where they can receive therapy services, as well as, of course, going through our insurance plan. In addition, they can always reach out to benefits office, and they will help kind of go through and connect them to supports. Also, through our professional learning this year, we're doing supportive environments, which helps. We started off the year like taking care of themselves and trying to reiterate how important that is, as this is a challenging time we're in, and we're acknowledging and looking at ways to continue to support that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that. I think that's valuable information for parents, for teachers, and certainly for students to have. Thank you so much for being with us. And Chief Bethel, back to you. As I was preparing for this conversation, I was reading that homicides in Philadelphia hit an all-time high of either 561 or 562 last year. We're up to 400 for this year, as I'm sure you well know. Gun violence is the leading cause of death for children over 15 in Philadelphia. Just as someone who has been part of the police force, who is the chief safety officer, what do you make of those numbers?
They're staggering. And before I begin to answer, I do also want to mention Saul High School, where Nicholas went, and really their prayers for them as well. But it's staggering. But I think we also have to be cautious, because sometimes we look at these as yearly. Like in my time in the Philadelphia Police Department, doesn't start the clock. I think sometimes we look at the end of the year, it's December 31st, and down January starts another day. There have been thousands of young people who have been killed on our streets over the last, 4 to 5 years, and then going back in time. And so if we don't really, really start to have a hard conversation about what are we going to do about this violence, this cycle will not stop. And we need to get everyone, all of our leaders in across the city, to sit at a table and come to some significant, because we have to deal with the now. What we're missing in the process, prevention and intervention, are the most important things that we can have. But there's also a part around enforcement. And if we're not going to deal with the issue of what's going on right now, and that is usually done by policing, and usually done because I am not a proponent of locking someone up after they shoot someone or after they kill someone. I'm a proponent of getting up front and getting those individuals who are out there in the community with guns who are shooting and killing our kids. And so if we're not going to take a more directed approach, then unfortunately we're going to continue to see this cycle over and over again. And so it is absolutely most frustrating to sit here as someone who has been a part of the city, who loves the city, who grew up in the city, to see where they were allowing our children to die on the streets, and everyone keeps talking about the next thing, or what are we about to do, or what we thought about doing. We need to talk about what we're going to do today to stop the violence in our city.
Chief Bethel, thanks so much for making time to be with us on the Regional Roundup. Kevin Bethel is a former deputy police commissioner. He is the chief safety officer for the School District of Philadelphia. We also heard from Dr. Jamie Banks, the deputy chief of prevention, intervention, and trauma for the School District of Philadelphia. Thanks so much to you both. Up next, a new Alzheimer's drug seems to slow the rate of cognitive decline for people in the early stages of the disease. We'll find out how it works and when it might be approved when the Roundup comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. There is new hope for people in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. An experimental drug has yielded impressive results in a clinical trial of 1,800 patients. It slowed the rate of cognitive decline by 27% in those who took the drug compared to the placebo. Lecanemab could be a game changer. It's the most promising so far in a class of Alzheimer's drugs that in the past have either failed or yielded mixed results. Joining us with more on what we know about this medication and how it works and what may happen next is Jason Karlowicz, professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and co-director of the Penn Memory Center. His most recent book is The Problem of Alzheimer's: How Science, Culture, and Politics Turned a Rare Disease into a Crisis and What We Can Do. Professor Karlowicz, Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here this morning, Tracy.
So it's important to say at the outset that we really don't have a ton of information about this drug yet, correct?
That's correct, yeah. The companies, Eisai and Biogen, last week Tuesday issued a press release summarizing the results. And this is understandable. They're companies and they're required under the law, if they have material information, to use the term of art in business, that could affect the stock price, to release that information. And so they had to do this, but it is simply a press release, several hundred words. Obviously, as a physician, what I need to see is a publication in a peer-reviewed journal, as well as presentations at scientific meetings, and those are forthcoming.
How soon do you think you'll see that information?
November 29th, San Francisco, sometime in the afternoon, there'll be a presentation of the results at the Clinical Trials on Alzheimer's Disease Conference. I do hope that's a presentation with ample time for questions and debate and discussion. And the company has said, and some of the representatives who I've corresponded with, that a paper is soon to be submitted to a journal. So that could happen, that paper could happen expeditiously as well. There's a lot of interest in this drug, as you can imagine.
No doubt. And my understanding is that this drug targets the amyloid plaque buildup in the brain that's characteristic of Alzheimer's. And other drugs, as you well know, have been designed to do the same thing, but haven't seemed to slow the progression of the disease. So I'm wondering what makes this drug, this lecanemab, different from others in its class?
This is a drug that targets amyloid, and several other drugs of a similar mechanism have also been tested and not succeeded. They're all not the same, obviously. They target different bits of the amyloid plaque, the oligofibrils and the protofibrils, or the plaque. Those specifics aren't worth getting into detail, but these drugs are all not the same, and so mechanism is different. In addition, the trial designs over time have been evolving. It's only in the last several years, for example, that we required individuals to have documented evidence of amyloid uptake before they received the drug or placebo. Finally, the study went on for 18 months, a year and a half. Arguably, that length of time in a disease that's slow was enough to detect a signal, whereas if, say, you tested one of these drugs and only for, say, 3 months or 6 months, the drug may be effective, but you just aren't going to detect that comparing the two groups because not enough time has passed for people to, sadly, have the changes seen with the disease and to detect the effect of the drug on that. So a number of factors. Again, you know, if the data that were reported hold up, this drug is an effective drug.
And can you talk about the significance of the findings? A 27% slowdown in cognitive decline sounds like a lot, and yet there are some researchers who are calling that modest. So I'm wondering, number one, how significant is that number? And two, what does a 27% slowdown actually look like in the life of someone who is diagnosed with Alzheimer's?
Well, it's more than 0%, but that's a quip. Let's walk back a bit. You know, the one thing has haunted the Alzheimer's field since the early days of drug development that led to drugs like the donepezil, et cetera. The one thing that's haunted the field is, unlike most other common diseases, particularly diseases seen in aging, the ways we measure this drug's benefits to a patient are not as transparent as, say, cancer, where it's about survival, heart disease, where it's about fewer heart attacks, less breathlessness, et cetera. And this disease, the ways we talk about effective drugs is far more opaque. The primary measure in this study to show whether the drug was treating a patient is a measure called the clinical dementia rating, known as the CDR. I don't expect any listeners other than my colleagues who might be listening here to know about what the CDR is. It measures, it's an interview that it measures cognition and function by talking to both the patient and their family member. when I look at the results, what I pay attention to, I never mind the percent issue. I think that's going to be a big distraction. How many point change was there on the CDR? And what's important in this is that most of the folks in this study were at the very low end of the CDR scale, meaning fairly mild, clustered up around the low scores. What they detected was a 0.45 point difference between drug and placebo. Doesn't seem like a lot on a scale that's 18 points, but again, folks were all clustered at the low end. And it's, I think we're still going to be learning here, but 0.45 difference there starts to be a difference that's more than trivial. But the larger issue here is what you have is a disease that causes progressive declines in function slowly, inexorably over time. And is that difficult to detect? Yeah, but over enough time do people look back and say, wow, his mind is really different. He's a bit different than the way he was. His function, yes, they do. And this drug suggests that it may delay the time before people start to notice there's been a change in my relative. I'm feeling a change in myself.
Hmm. Dr. Karlowicz, do you know anything about how researchers identified who qualified for this trial?
Yeah. So to be able to take this drug in the clinical trial that it was tested, and therefore, if it's approved by FDA, my hunch is the label that will be written, I hope, specifies that an individual has to have impairments in their cognition, meaning not just feeling that their cognition isn't as good as it used to be, but actually when it's assessed and tested, indeed their performance is below what would be expected, and that those cognitive impairments are causing either inefficiencies or disabilities in daily life. Namely, it's taking a lot longer for me to do the finances. I'm making a few mistakes, but catching them, inefficiencies, or disabilities. I just can't do the checkbook anymore. These are people with either what we call mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia. And then the final bit, and this is very important, is the need to be tested for evidence of amyloid in the brain. And if there's evidence of cognitive impairment within that range that I described and evidence of elevated amyloid in the brain, all of the things being equal, if you will, that person would have been enrolled in that clinical trial and, if the drug's approved, would be eligible to take the drug because they have evidence of Alzheimer's disease causing their cognitive impairment.
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. And Dr. Karlowicz, to that question about who participated, is there any information on the demographics of the group in terms of, you know, how many women may have been part of this, how many people of color may have been included in the study?
Yeah, there are 1,800 people in the study, which for an Alzheimer's study is a pretty big sample size. It was a one-to-one assignment to either drug or placebo by the flip of a coin. So basically 900 people got drug, 900 people got placebo. big numbers to be sure, although given the numbers of people with the disease, very tiny numbers. And so one must always be cautious when you make inferences about safety and efficacy until the drug's used in wider practice. What also was notable in the study for that is about 25% of the participants were people who self-identified as Black, African-American, or Latino, Hispanic race ethnicity. Compared to other Alzheimer's trials, and frankly compared to many other diseases clinical trials, that's a notable diversity with respect to race and ethnicity, which suggests that efforts to give equal access and improve access to clinical trials for this study were successful. And that's something that we can also learn from. What did the companies do that fostered that level of that proportion of participation, which is pretty unusual for a clinical trial in Alzheimer's disease?
Can you talk about how it would be administered?
It's intravenously infused. Roughly, I believe, every 4 weeks. Don't quote me. So it does require coming into an infusion center every 4 weeks.
And what about side effects? What do we know about that at this point?
Yeah, side effects for lecanemab, as well as drugs in the anti-amyloid class, fairly consistent. Namely, small areas in the brain of swelling, edema is the other term we use, swelling, edema, there are synonyms. Or small areas of bleeding. These can be detected with MRIs even before someone's symptomatic. They're more frequent than in individuals on placebo. They can cause not just some symptoms of headache, not to trivialize headache, but can cause troubles with gait and lead to falls, et cetera, even if the drug's been stopped. So it's not a risk-free drug, and I think for an individual patient and their family, you know, a conversation will need to be unfold with some time to sort of think and reflect, are the benefits of the drug worth those risks? And They're well quantified in the study, that, you know, the chances over time that one would have those events. It's very well understood.
So I'm just, and I'm certainly not a doctor, but that sounds serious to me, swelling, bleeding of the brain. If doctors were to see those kinds of side effects, what happens then? What's the treatment for that?
You stop the drug, yeah. Full stop. Depending on the severity of the edema and the number of hemorrhages and the severity, there are protocols that are being developed that can restart the drug with close monitoring versus complete cessation. I think the important point for listeners is this drug, if it's approved, and I'm prescribing it at the Memory Center along with my colleagues, for example, this will be a learning for us. We will, no question, learn more about these risks as well as the benefits as the drug is used in wider clinical practice in individuals who have other diseases, et cetera. I mean, the important point, I think, the message about the risks and benefits of this drug, like any drug, is when it's studied in 1,800 people, you do learn things enough to say it works and here's the risks, but you're going to learn more in clinical practice when not 1,800 but 18,000, yeah. You know, hundreds of thousands of people use it. You definitely learn more, and sometimes you're impressed with further evidence of benefit, and other times you're rather disappointed as you discover more risks, et cetera.
Yeah. Any idea yet how expensive this drug could be?
No. Companies not discuss price, which makes sense. I mean, I think it's a bit premature, perhaps. I will say, if past pricing is predictive, when Biogen's drug was approved by FDA, Biogen, in June 7th of 2021, Biogen initially put it on the market for essentially $60,000 a year. And the ensuing aftermath of that very controversial and mistaken FDA approval, the company ultimately cut the price to around $20,000. Don't quote me on the exact numbers. I thought that was a big reveal because it suggested they'd baked a fair amount of profit into that price. So to be determined what the price will be, but I think the numbers I'm saying, even if you go with the low number there, $20,000, potentially, you know, we're talking about a fairly expensive drug here. This obviously presents challenges to society in terms of, you know, the cost of the drug, and that will be, I am quite certain, an ongoing conversation.
Yeah. You have written about how, as important as medications are, that Alzheimer's patients and their families need more than drugs, that they need greater support, and that finding it has been an uphill battle. Do you feel like things are getting any better in that regard?
Well, at least there's recognition of what you just said. In other words, I hear other people saying what I've said as well. I think if you ask and talk with folks in government, legislative branch, et cetera, they'll admit that from their own personal experiences. I'd like to see a little action, though, in that space to move along to help America, for example, have in place a system of long-term care services and supports that rivals the system we have paid for through Medicare to deliver medical care. We're not there yet. There's bits of that. We're in the original Recovery Act that Biden had proposed, but that all got cut out by the time it became signed into law recently, which is a huge disappointment. You know, we're not going to drug our way out of this problem such that we look back like we did with polio at one point and say, just get your vaccine, you'll never get polio. Much like cancer and heart disease, I think we should expect, and lecanemab, I think, could be the beginning of great progress in affecting the natural history of the disease. But even the most optimistic take on the benefits of lecanemab show that you still are going to be symptomatic and suffer some disability over time, just not as rapidly. So these drugs are not going to remove the ability to help the American family live with and care for and help an American live with disabling cognitive impairments. And I really hope, if it takes a drug to wake up America to this, well, so be it. We could have done it without the drug. But it's my hope that we finally wake up and develop a system that delivers quality long-term care services and supports.
Question from a listener here. Jim asks, why is it so hard to find a treatment for Alzheimer's?
It is and it isn't. Jim, I hear you. That was a typical academic answer. if you look in the arc of history, it wasn't until 2002, roughly, that we could actually visualize amyloid in the brain of a living human. Prior to that, you had to die and have a neuropathologist see it, because otherwise it was we had no way to detect it. So just about 20 years ago, we finally were able to see amyloid. But fast forward about 10, 15 more years, we were finally able to see tau. And it was only the last 5-6 years that we were designing our clinical trials to measure these biomarkers in individuals. So that's small beer, perhaps, for people who, you know, are living with the disease now, or sadly are in the advanced stages or died of it, I realize. But, you know, in the arc of history, that's pretty rapid progress to go from not being able to detect the disease at all in a living human, biologically detect it, to now have a drug that quite possibly is altering the natural history. There's also progress in targeting other pathologies. I think one of the lessons the field has learned is it's not just amyloid. There's other pathologies at work here. And so I think generally the chatter is, we should see a future where different kinds of approaches are available to treat the disease, perhaps even in combination.
And are there other drugs currently in the pipeline that seem to be showing promise, or is it too early to say?
There are. There's two other anti-amyloid therapies that are currently very close to completing their studies and therefore have their data analyzed and reported out, much like lecanemab. One is a drug called gantenerumab, and the other is a drug called donanemab. You can see a certain common nomenclature to express the antibody aspect of them, given their mechanism. We'll hear about both those studies no later than mid of 2023. So in less than a year, two more drugs possibly will be out there that also have similar effects as lecanemab, that is to say mechanism, et cetera. Again, those are coming up. And behind them, are other studies as well of both anti-amyloid approaches and other approaches targeting the disease.
And, Doctor, very quickly, in 15 seconds or less, is it possible that a drug like lecanemab could be taken preventatively?
That's a possible future. Studies are ongoing to test just that aspect. The goal of them is not so much, I think, if looking at the benefits of lecanemab to prevent the disease, but to further delay the onset, meaning it will take longer before you develop symptoms.
Jason Karlowicz is professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and co-director of the Penn Memory Center. His most recent book is The Problem of Alzheimer's. Dr. Karlowicz, thank you so much for making time to be with us.
Thanks so much, Tracy. Pleasure to be on.
And up next, they weigh less than a sunflower seed, but those monarch butterflies are migrating from Canada to Cape May. We'll talk more about that when the roundup comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisek in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Well, it must be fall because the monarchs are on the move. Those beautiful orange and black butterflies are making their annual migration from Canada to Cape May, New Jersey, and then on to Mexico or Southern California for the winter. It is a 3,000-mile trip through all kinds of weather, and some don't survive it. Those that do will die before the return trip in the spring. Their offspring will actually finish the journey. These fascinating creatures weigh about as much as a sunflower seed, and they dazzle with their beauty, but they are in danger of dying off. There are a number of reasons for that, including climate change. Joining us with more on the flight and the plight of the monarchs is Dr. Emil DeVito, Manager of Science and Stewardship at the New Jersey Conservation Foundation. Thank you so much for being with us on the Regional Roundup.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, as I mentioned, monarchs are in trouble. Give us an idea of how much the population has dwindled in recent years.
Well, that western population that you mentioned that winters in on the California coast is in severe trouble. They've diminished, incredibly, and they're critically endangered. There are very few left compared to what there once were.
Yeah. What about the eastern ones? Those are the ones that stop in Cape May on their way to Mexico. They also have declined.
Sure. So the population in the east is much more widespread, and many of the monarch butterflies that are coming out of New England and the coastal areas, do make it to Cape May, and then after a rest stop there, they make it across Delaware Bay and head south. That population has declined precipitously, but it's still, you know, they're still a common sight. It's not as if they're on the verge of extinction.
Yeah.
But, you know, they face incredible obstacles. The wintering habitat is one very small area of moist tropical forest in the mountains of Mexico, not too far to the east of Mexico City. And that habitat has been greatly diminished by, you know, habitat conversion to agriculture and other purposes. Yeah. So their wintering ground is become very small and isolated.
So has the population dwindled enough that they're considered an endangered species at this point?
I actually don't know the classification for the eastern population, the federal classification, but it really isn't. It really wouldn't matter that much because the things that affect them don't just affect, you know, one place. When you have an endangered bird or an endangered turtle or an endangered reptile like a snake, you know, you have to protect the breeding ground, make sure that the habitat is good for them. But the monarch butterfly depends upon so many different habitats scattered across thousands of miles, right? So, and the things that are affecting them aren't so much the availability of land, but what's being done to that land.
Yeah.
So you have, you know, diminished meadows where they require two different sets of plants, right? They need to lay their eggs on milkweeds because the milkweeds possess chemicals that the monarchs sequester in their bodies and use to defend themselves from being eaten by birds. The monarch butterflies are not affected by these chemicals that would normally be distasteful. And so birds learn not to prey on monarch butterflies by their color pattern. Mm-hmm. And so we need lots of habitat with the milkweeds so that the adult butterflies can lay their eggs on the milkweeds, and then the caterpillars sequester these chemicals, and then the monarchs are protected by those chemicals once a juvenile bird learns that it's a distasteful thing.
Yeah.
Birds actually have to learn that. They don't know automatically that the monarchs are distasteful. But once they eat, you know, try to eat one or two, then they learn that that's not a good idea.
Yeah. And I just want to make a quick note here, Dr. DeVito, from our producer, we were talking about being endangered, and we have a note here saying that the federal classification is not endangered. They do not have federal protection, at least at this point, and that's for both populations, east and west. But and forgive me for interrupting you there, but we're also talking about some of the causes here, and you've been talking about, you know, chemicals, talking about milkweed. We know that there are the neonicotinoids. Mm-hmm. Is that, am I saying that right? Can you explain what they are and why they are a problem?
Sure. Let me just make one comment about the status. So this is often the case that when an animal population is dropping, it takes a long time to have the government declare things threatened or endangered. And often the process happens way too late.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for things like insects, and especially for things where you can't pinpoint the cause. So again, the status is not going to be what saves the monarch butterfly. It's going to be doing things like banning neonicotinoids. They've been banned. Most of the seriously dangerous ones have been banned in Europe. They're used to coat seeds. And so by coating crop seeds, the insects that would prey on seeds in the ground don't, you know, they don't prey on the seeds. But then the plants keep those compounds in them, and they're incredibly toxic. Just a few molecules of neonicotinoids can kill pollinators, everything from bees to butterflies. And so what we have is a landscape now that is just where these neonicotinoids are just everywhere.
Yeah.
And so it's really difficult because for instance, if you're a homeowner and you're careful to make sure that you buy only native flowers that are not grown with neonicotinoid-coated seeds, and you have a wonderful meadow in your yard, and the monarch butterflies come to your yard, when they leave your yard and go around the corner, if someone has plants that are bought in box stores where they're grown with neonicotinoids, then they just move to the next spot, and then it's a poisonous place.
And they were banned in New Jersey as well, is that right? I know you said that in many parts of Europe. I had heard that they were banned in Jersey and at least are being considered to be banned in some other states.
Right. So in just recently, New Jersey passed a law, and now they're not going to be able to be bought as applications to lawns. It's not just that they coat seeds with them. They're also spread on lawns and, you know, used as just general insecticides. So New Jersey has banned them from gardening and lawn applications. You won't be able to buy them in stores, but unfortunately, agriculture is exempt. So that's still the vast majority of the landscape is still, able to use neonicotinoid-coated seeds. And even, for example, in New Jersey, we have state parks and state forests that are leased to farmers, literally thousands of acres of publicly owned land that are leased to farmers, and the farmers can still use those kinds of seeds. So just now I drove past Rancocas State Park on the Rancocas Creek in Moorestown, New Jersey, on my way here, and, you know, that farmland has crops that are grown with neonicotinoid-coated seeds. Mm. The other problem is Roundup, which is used. They're Roundup-ready crops, soybeans, corn, all sorts of crops where Roundup is sprayed many times during the course of the year to kill all the other plants. But the Roundup-ready crops are not affected by the Roundup. But then all the good food plants that are on the edges of the farm fields are killed off. Yeah. So we have many different things that are impacting the habitat. Another impact is deer, because deer preferentially eat native species of wildflowers. And so many of our habitats that used to be terrific for monarch butterflies, such as hedgerows on the edges of farm fields and that type of thing, they're becoming overrun with alien species that don't provide any nectar for the migrating butterflies. So there's just any number of impacts to their habitat.
I want to talk about the journey, because it's fascinating, and I'm wondering how they know how to get from Canada all the way to Mexico every year, never having made the journey before. And I'm especially curious about why Cape May.
Well, so the last monarchs have a number of generations. When they leave the mountains of Mexico, they move north, and they may breed in the southern United States, and then their offspring move further north. And then by the end of the summer, you have, you know, many generations down the road. The last generation that the caterpillars pupate in August or early September, and the butterflies emerge in September. And that last generation of butterflies is programmed genetically to migrate to Mexico. They don't learn it. They just it's just in their DNA.
Yeah.
And it's only that generation.
And what about Cape May? Why there? Why do they stop there?
Well, that's true for birds also, and many other species that migrate, of many other migrating species of butterflies and insects. Everything coming out of New England, you know, reaches the southern New England coastline and then is funneled across the New York City area and then down the Jersey coast. And then Cape May, naturally, is the shortest crossing point between to get across Delaware Bay. So birds, butterflies, other insects, they all accumulate at the tip of Cape May and then finally make that last jump across Delaware Bay when the winds are favorable to go further down the coastline. So it's just sort of like a funnel.
There are organizations that have been tagging monarchs to help track their journey. Can you talk about how that's done and what can we learn from that?
Well, I haven't done that myself. I've seen it done. Tiny tags are put on the wing of the butterfly, you know, with virtually no weight, so that it doesn't alter or impact their flight. And then later on, those butterflies, people have monitoring stations, you know, all along the coast and all along the route, and then also in the mountains of Mexico, so we can determine, you know, how long it takes the butterflies, how many rest over stops they need, that kind of thing, to fuel up again with, you know, hopefully good nectar sources. And, you know, so that's been going on for, I would imagine, about 20 years or so. And so we've learned a lot about what the butterflies need and where they go and you know, that they need all these stopover points that are safe and healthy. But the larger problem is, you know, what we're doing to the landscape and, you know, the chemicals, the agricultural industry, the lawn and garden industry. Those things really need to change because we're just – it's not just butterflies. I mean, pollinators en masse are dying out across the planet. Huge drops in all sorts of pollinator populations, including bees. And it's all because of chemical impacts.
To that point, I have a question from a listener. Luann asks, I know that planting milkweed can help support monarchs, but what kind of milkweed is best, and how much of it do you need to support them? She says she assumes that one or two would not be enough.
Every plant helps. They're really good at finding, you know, the milkweed plants to lay their eggs. Common milkweed is the easiest species to grow, and the one that they use most often, also swamp milkweed. They're very easy to buy at native plant nurseries. They do really well in gardens. They can even be a little bit aggressive and, you know, spread on their own. So it's really easy to grow lots of milkweed in your yard and, you know, get rid of some lawn. But you have to make sure that when you do this that you're growing plants that have where neonicotinamides have not been used, and that's often difficult to figure out. Most native plant nurseries that specialize in native plants don't use those kinds of chemicals.
Yeah. What other things can people do if they're interested in trying to help these monarchs on their journey, maybe even attract them to their backyard? We know that milkweed, obviously, is an excellent choice, but are there other things that people can do to help?
Right. So milkweed's not blooming now. So the milkweeds are for the caterpillars, for the adults that are coming north to lay their eggs on the leaves and for the caterpillars. And those summer generations do feed on milkweed, the adults' nectar on milkweed. But you need to have a whole variety of nectar sources of wildflowers that, you know, butterflies are attracted to, especially during fall migration, so that they can fuel up and, you know, convert that nectar to energy that they need to power that many thousand mile migration.
And it sounds like you have to be careful and ask some questions as you're thinking about what to plant and ways to try to help these monarchs and to attract them and make sure that your plants are safe, that you've got to make sure that you're asking the right questions when you're purchasing seeds, when you're getting ready to do the planting.
Right. Well, the best thing to do is, you know, search around for the nearest native plant nursery. Those folks at native plant nurseries generally are, you know, growing things that are safe, and also they can tell you how to plant and take care of those plants properly. But the main thing that people need to do is to write to their legislators, both state and federal, because if we don't change the chemical industry, we're not going to change the course of what's happening to the monarchs.
Yeah. What would you say is their prognosis? I mean, we talked about the population dwindling both for Eastern and for Western, and you said more for the Western variety at this point. If nothing changes, what would be your prognosis for the monarch butterfly in the United States?
Well, like I said, the Western population is critically endangered, and it's, you know, questionable as to whether we can do anything in time, especially given that there's no status. Sometimes if there's a status, you know, that might help put pressure on the government to deal with the things like the chemical problems.
Yeah.
But the Eastern population is widespread and large. And there's still, you know, a large number of butterflies. Their population fluctuates. They've had some bad years and some good years recently. Overall, it's come down quite a bit from what it was, you know, 40 or 50 years ago. But, you know, we can reverse that if we, you know, get back to having healthy habitats in meadows, on the edges of farms, you know, the land use practices that we can employ can really benefit them. And I think that there's, you know, a chance that we can rescue that population from this decline. But it's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take some really serious governmental regulation change also.
Yeah. We have been talking about the monarch butterfly. The fall is the time when they make their migration from Canada to Cape May, New Jersey, and then on to Mexico for the winter. It is a fascinating 3,000-mile journey for these tiny insects. They weigh about the amount of a sunflower seed, and somehow they know how to get there. But, of course, they are in trouble. The population has been dwindling. We want to say a special thank you to our guest, Dr. Emil DeVito, Manager of Science Science and Stewardship at the New Jersey Conservation Foundation. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY. Our producer is Paige Marie Bessler. Our engineer today was Diana Martinez. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan.